Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by Carium, the telehealth platform enabling healthcare's digital transformation, helping you care for people within the fabric of their daily lives. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Andrew Van Landingham, Senior Counselor for Policy at the HHS Office of the Inspector General. So Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Matt. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today and connect with your listeners.
So Andrew, what I always like to do before getting into the main part of the discussion is give my guests a chance to provide more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So the floor is yours.
Yeah, so I am a senior counselor for policy, as you mentioned, at the Health and Human Services Inspector General's Office. And so my long title, my long last name, just mean I'm a career civil servant. I've worked at OIG for 12 years. And the best way to explain my job is I work at this sort of intersection of the law, policy, and oversight, which is an interesting intersection, especially when it comes to health technology. Largely speaking, we want to understand where the industry and where government is going so that we can more effectively oversee it to do our work related to law enforcement, audits, evaluations, all the things that OIG does.
So what attracted you to coming into that intersection of legal, policy, and oversight sphere within healthcare?
Yeah, so I think like anyone in healthcare goes back to sort of a personal story. Growing up, one of my formative memories was seeing my mother struggle with my grandparents as they aged into a long-term care facility. My grandfather was both a Medicare beneficiary, he was a Ma Bell pensioner, and was a World War II vet. And watching my mom struggle with the overlapping coverage to get him the sort of stuff he needed to recover from a stroke was personally the most frustrated I've ever seen my mom. On top of that, also caring for her mom, who was in a wheelchair with osteoporosis, who constantly kept getting either new wheelchairs or braces sent to her home, was sort of a dual effect of watching, you know, my grandfather, who really needed help with a stroke, struggle to get the care he needed, and then my grandmother get too much for things that she really didn't need. And that really opened my eyes to the sort of inefficiencies in our healthcare system. In a very personal way. And so based on that experience, explored what I could do to make a difference, and went to law school to get a little bit smarter. And from there, decided that, you know, the sort of world of healthcare policy was more interesting. And my first job in the federal government was as a presidential management fellow at the Veterans Health Administration. And so after working at the VHA for a bit, I decided to go over to OIG to really hone my legal skills again, but still keep that policy angle in and all of our sort of oversight work. So that's the sort of personal touch of how I got to where I am today, and know that many folks in there have a similar story of a struggle that they or a family member had, and that drives a lot of the good work folks do across the industry.
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely right. Having a personal connection in some level of a personal story is very much a common theme that tends to come up. But kind of as you're describing, I think it's a great way to now ask, you know, kind of what does the OIG do? Because I think oftentimes the OIG gets either negative press or just a negative connotation, because people assume that if the OIG is coming to talk to you, then you've done something bad, which I suspect is not always the case.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Matt. First and foremost, OIG is a people-driven mission, right? Our job is to make sure that all of the HHS programs work efficiently, effectively for the nearly every single American citizen that it touches. Everyone in America, I think, is affected in some way by an HHS program, whether that's Medicare or Medicaid covering, you know, nearly one in three lives from an insurance perspective, but also obviously from a public health perspective, the CDC, NIH for medical research. There's no American who isn't affected by those programs. And so our job really is to make sure those work as best as possible for everyone in the country. And so with that people focus, our job often gets confused because we also have a law enforcement angle, because, you know, there are unfortunately criminals who want to take advantage of these giant programs that put out, you know, billions of dollars each year, whether it's healthcare, medical research, or a variety of other things. And our job is to make sure those criminals can't take advantage of the programs and don't, you know, harm beneficiaries who really need those services or may need those dollars to support whatever health or human service that they need. And so the law enforcement angle gets a lot of attention, especially in the legal world from a compliance perspective. But we also do a lot of oversight that I think helps make these programs work better for beneficiaries. A great example is just this past week, early in May, we released a report looking at Medicare Advantage organizations and found that, you know, they were denying at around a 15% rate claims for beneficiaries that should have been covered normally by Medicare, including, you know, a beneficiary who had suffered a fall and obviously needed services to sort of recover from that fall. And that's something that, you know, doesn't have a whole lot of transparency, but, you know, folks want to make sure that Medicare Advantage works for Medicare beneficiaries now that, you know, we're getting closer to 50% of folks enrolled there. And our work helps make sure that that's transparent so that Congress, CMS, and others can correct those issues and that make sure that beneficiaries ultimately get the care they need. So it's an interesting sort of perspective that, you know, both the sort of criminal element that takes advantage of programs, but also very much a human element to make sure that these programs work as they're intended.
So it really sounds like you get to take a very holistic view of the entire industry and not only just consider it and evaluate it from every angle, but also get an opportunity to step in and help either identify areas for improvement or, you know, I think as you're just talking about, be able to take action to stop activities that are detrimental to the system.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, on the criminal angle, we deal with everything from organized crime, like mafia types, that most folks probably don't realize are involved in healthcare fraud, right? Very intentional criminal organizations whose only purpose is to, you know, bilk the system out of money. And that often involves, you know, harm to beneficiaries. Recently in Florida, we found a very sophisticated criminal organization had, you know, basically kidnapped an elderly adult, locked him in a closet, and then made him the sort of sham owner of several home health agencies down in Florida. And obviously, rescuing that individual from that circumstance was our key objective once we figured out that's what was going on. But we got there because they were perpetrating, you know, a large amount of fraud on the health end. So that is definitely one angle. But as you said, yeah, at the end of the day, we want these programs to work for the folks they're intended to serve. You know, Medicaid eligibility, a great issue that I know a lot of folks are looking at as maybe the public health emergency unwinds. We want that to work well for beneficiaries, but there's been lots of issues with states, you know, maybe not doing it as effectively as they could with high error rates, folks not being able to navigate tricky systems. And I know that your audience with a technology bent understands how complicated something like an eligibility verification system might be. And so our job is to go in and make sure that, you know, CMS and states fix that so that, you know, beneficiaries can appropriately enroll if they're eligible and make sure that it's easier on them with hopefully a few less hurdles in the way.
And as you're looking at, you know, pursuing some of those objectives of making sure that different pieces of the system are working efficiently or working as they're intended to, you know, what are the tools in your tool chest that allow you to go in and perform that work?
Yeah, and I think, you know, most folks, if you're a lawyer, are familiar with our subpoena power, the sort of law enforcement side. But on our oversight side, you know, we essentially get to piggyback on the department. And so if the department has access to data, to money, to anything at a provider, OIG gets that access under sort of the law that created inspectors general. And so, you know, if you're a Medicare provider billing CMS, you know, you have to provide certain things to CMS in order to be either certified or to bill appropriately. We get access to all that stuff. And so really the way we best do our job is through that access to data that piggybacks on the department. Ultimately, that's what gives us the ability to go in and take a deep dive into what's going on. Even at an organization as big as CMS, you know, they don't have endless resources. And so having us there to go in and double check to see what's going on helps spot problems before maybe they become huge issues and can get addressed at that sort of beginning point rather than later on down the road.
Yeah, no, and I think that makes sense. You know, if, as you're saying, it's, you know, you get that chance to get in early, start reviewing things and really be a backup to the rest of the department, you know, because I think as many people recognize, it's always very helpful to have a second set of eyes on whatever you're doing. And especially if you're administering programs that are so wide, you know, widespread and touch on so many aspects of people's lives, the more people that you can have supporting the mission and supporting the assessment of what's happening is should end up being for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, telehealth, you know, topic that maybe your listeners are interested in is a great example, right? We're obviously packing in a lot of experimentation on sort of telehealth delivery during the pandemic, and everyone from Congress to the White House, the department, they want to know, well, what's going on? What's working? What isn't? Of course, CMS and others in the department are evaluating that, but as an independent objective agency, we get to go in and take a look too. And so it's important that that voice is there to make sure that there is the sort of independent watchdog, so that problems aren't glossed over, that they're addressed and fixed. And that way it works better for everyone. You know, ultimately, our job is to make sure, especially on the healthcare side, that things like telehealth work for patients, they work for providers, and they work for the federal healthcare programs.
And kind of as you just said, telehealth is a good example, since it's, you know, become such a ubiquitous part of the discussion in healthcare. But that one seems like it's an easy one, because, you know, utilization just skyrocketed because of relaxations or waivers or, you know, all the innumerable actions that happened as a result of the pandemic. You know, aside from that, you know, how does OIG determine its priorities, whether it's for that, for its oversight purview, or even for the enforcement side of things?
Yeah, it's a great question, Matt. And it's also a complex process, right? We're from a budget perspective, to kind of give folks the constraint here, we get about $400 million a year to oversee the roughly $2.4 trillion that flows to or through the Department of Health and Human Services. So $400 million is a lot of money, but to oversee that much, it's not terribly a lot. I think it's like 0.0017%. And so we have to be ruthless in our prioritization in terms of the work that we do. And so on the sort of oversight side, where we're conducting audits and evaluations, it involves sort of a complex risk assessment, but we are definitely a data-driven organization. Back to that sort of data access piece, and we have real-time access to Medicare and most Medicaid data. And so we're constantly assessing outliers, what's going on, what are the trends to help guide us in those decisions. And of course, we get inputs from other areas too. It's not just data, it's conversations with the department, departmental leadership, with industry, to understand what's going on to best tailor our risk. So, you know, something like the unaccompanied children and the migration at the southern border crisis, you know, a couple of years ago, that's obviously something that no one quite planned for, but we quickly pivoted to make sure that we were addressing those issues, since HHS is the department in charge of sort of the custody of those kids once they're across the border. And then on the enforcement side, it's a complex mix. You know, we could be doing, you know, probably 50 to 100 more cases a year if we had the resources, probably more than that. And so we really have to prioritize the worst criminal behavior, the sorts of actions that have the most harm on beneficiaries and on the department. And so working with the Department of Justice and with other law enforcement partners, we're constantly looking at allegations to understand what's their size and scope, and making tough choices to really focus on the toughest stuff that's out there.
Yeah, and I think you're making a great point of, you know, there's always constraints in, because of time, resources, or any other number of factors that can, you know, limit what can be done. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Andrew Van Landingham of the OIG, talking about kind of the work of the OIG and the priority setting. And, you know, I guess one final question I've got on that priority aspect is, you know, how does that feed into the OIG's work plan, which, you know, might also be an opportunity to maybe give people insight in terms of what that is? Because I, you know, I think as lawyer, you know, on the legal side, we all look for it when it comes out for initially each year, and then look for all the updates. But, you know, if you don't mind providing a little bit of background on what it is, and then, you know, kind of how would that get, you know, what the process looks like in terms of updating it, I guess, year over year, or frankly, probably within the course of a year, because I certainly see the updates come out mid-year as well.
Yeah. And one thing that we've changed, you know, I guess in the recent years, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, is we do update our work plan monthly. And essentially, the work plan is all of the audits and evaluations that we're either conducting or plan to conduct shortly. And so it updates monthly to basically add new audits or evaluations, and then remove the ones that are completed since that work has been posted. And how an idea goes from, you know, an auditor, an evaluator, to an approved plan, we actually have a very robust internal process because of that sort of complex risk assessment that's needed to make sure we're allocating our resources effectively. And so we have a group of OIG executives who meet weekly to discuss those ideas, to make sure that we are pinpointing our resources to the biggest issues in the department based on our strategic plan and other sort of inputs that I mentioned earlier. And really that it's a great process because it also gives us a chance weekly to talk about, well, what is going on and is this the right work? And so obviously during COVID, we quickly had to pivot to, well, what work do we need to be doing to help really address the pandemic? And that's a great example of where, now I think we have 90 ongoing, or we have 90 total work plan items, 12 or 14 of which have been issued, with still many more ongoing. But most of those were done through that sort of risk assessment process and trying to understand a very dynamic situation in COVID and really get stuff up, but consistent with our strategic plan and our understanding of what's going on. And so it's a great way too for healthcare providers and others on the sort of legal and compliance end. And if we're identifying these as risks generally, they may also want to be looking at them internally at their own organizations. And I know that compliance officers and officials use that work plan quite a bit to do some of their own internal risk planning. And so we're also looking at upgrading the work plan process to make it a little more transparent for folks. And we had issued a sort of request for information, recognizing that that's a resource that folks use. So stay tuned. Hopefully we'll have even more improvements to that in the future. But definitely, if you've not seen our work plan before, suggest that folks take a look on our website.
Yeah, no, kind of as you just said, that's a great reminder that just understanding what the OIG is looking at and what is higher up on that priority list is very informative, because it gives, as you said, organizations a chance to do their own internal assessment, because hopefully they won't be a target, but it does let you give something to measure against. And certainly, as you were suggesting, from the compliance perspective, can help set agendas and priorities, which informs probably each company's own internal risk assessment as it's determining how to allocate its own resources.
Absolutely.
But what I want to do now is actually do a little bit of a big pivot to a different topic. And it's kind of what I heard you talking about recently, because you and I were able to meet recently at a conference, and you were talking about health equity. That's obviously become an extremely, I would say it's always been an important topic, but it's one that is actually getting more deserved attention at the forefront. Can you tell us a little bit about what OIG is doing from a health equity perspective, and how you see health equity issues continuing to arise and hopefully get more fruitful discussion going around them?
Yeah, Matt, thanks for raising this. And obviously one of the most crucial areas that I think everyone in healthcare is taking a look at. And as you mentioned, it's always been an important topic for, I think, everyone. But unfortunately, it took a pandemic for us to really see just how bad is it. And I think at OIG, for our part, we understand that making those issues more transparent, understanding those effects, is one step in that process. And so right now we're really committed to doing that oversight piece, looking at HHS programs to make sure that they have the capabilities to even spot health equity issues and the sort of disparate impacts that flow from that. And so, looking at some of our ongoing work right now, it's really focused on data, right? Does the CDC, does CMS, do they even have the data necessary to understand the sort of ways that their programs may have disproportionate effects, even unintentionally so? And I think that's something that we think is foundational to addressing the sort of downstream effects of health equity. But that's certainly not all we're doing. We're trying to bring an equity lens to nearly everything we're doing in telehealth, right? Trying to understand exactly who's using telehealth during this great experimentation phase will inform tweaks going forward to payment and other policies to help make sure that it benefits everyone and not just folks who may have easy access to technology. And I know that there was a health affairs article that was published in the May issue showing that Medicare beneficiaries in disadvantaged neighborhoods, there was an increase in telehealth utilization. So that's great. And so things like that, I think, will weave more into our work so that folks have a better understanding of, well, what are the effects and what are the limits at programs? So that way HHS can start addressing those on their own sense. And that'll help, I think, providers and others in the healthcare industry start addressing their effects at their own organization as well.
Yeah, and maybe I should have asked this as the initial, kind of framing of this topic. But as we're talking about health equity and all those initiatives that you were just describing OIG is undertaking, how does OIG actually define or view health equity? Because it's, again, one of those phrases or terms that seems to change definitions depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, trying to define it maybe is a little tough, but I think at the end of the day, every beneficiary for HHS programs deserves the opportunity to get the services they need and deserve, right? At the end of the day, those programs maybe need to be intentionally readjusted to recognize that folks have fallen through the cracks, not unintentionally so, but because of larger structural issues that have been there for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years, in some cases longer. And so defining it is, I think, less important than understanding the scope of it and how do you go about addressing it block by block, right? You can't just start addressing health equity without having data. And that's why we think some of that foundational work is important. It's understanding the problem, not necessarily the definition that we're focused on, and understanding where are the sort of nuts and bolts areas that the government needs to do better at to really grapple this. And also understand the incentives, right? I think, you know, in healthcare, understanding incentives is key to understanding why maybe folks have fallen through the cracks. And that's one thing that we're focused on too. And so, you know, one aspect of healthcare that overlaps both with OIG's mission and our authorities and health equity, I think, is value-based care. Right, aligning incentives and understanding what data folks have as they move from fee-for-service to value-based care is another great way that we can start weaving in health equity into more purpose-driven sort of payment policies.
So, you know, as you're kind of getting into these analyses and reviews, are there preliminary findings that you've already determined that are that you can talk to? And, you know, how, and if you can, how is that kind of further refining future plans and other ongoing efforts?
Yeah, so we do have work that's close to coming out that I can't talk to quite yet, but I will say it'll be an important look at, you know, how Medicare uses data and what data they have to assess the demographics of their beneficiaries. What we found there is already informing other work. And so, again, we think some of those foundational data issues are a key place to start. Same thing at CDC. We've got forthcoming work that's not quite yet public. But again, we'll show folks, I think, some of the limits at these large, well-funded government, you know, agencies. But we're not going to stop there, right? We're also looking at, you know, beyond that, utilization pieces where in Medicaid, for instance, we found in New Mexico, it's to no one's surprise that, you know, in rural and frontier areas in New Mexico, you know, folks just don't have access to the sort of things that make telehealth easy to use, broadband technology. And it's not just beneficiaries at home, it's providers out there too. It's the entire sort of telehealth economy out there. And so issues like that, where we're looking at, well, what are the sort of structures behind access to care in Medicaid and other programs are things that will build off that data. As we start to see what are those limits, we can start looking at, well, what are those effects?
Yeah. And I think kind of, as you just mentioned, you know, the work isn't just focusing on the delivery of care or the setup of structures. I think, as you just said, it's really looking at impacts on everyone involved, whether it be patients, care delivery, or the systems. I think it's an important reminder that it does need to be a complete review as opposed to just focusing on one particular side or perspective to any of these issues.
Absolutely. And, you know, government has its own limitations, right? Sometimes it can't collect data for very good reasons, legal or otherwise. And understanding how those limits play into, to your point, the whole picture is very important.
So kind of with the increased focus on health equity, you know, do you anticipate that there are going to be any policy or structural program or structural program changes that result from the findings?
Well, you know, we don't run the programs, but I mean, obviously, we're in close contact with CMS and our other colleagues. And I know that the CMS administrator and her entire staff is very focused on addressing aspects of health equity across all the programs that CMS runs, including, you know, their accountable care organization model, the ACO REACH plan, where they're building in more explicit health equity metrics as part of the sort of ACO care. And so I think looking ahead a little bit, without running programs, where OIG is on this is we see a lot of, especially in the healthcare space, sort of parallels between how providers want to address health equity and with the shift from fee-for-service to coordinated or value-based care. Now, as providers decide to take on more risk, they're more responsible for every individual in their population. And that may help folks who would have usually fallen through the cracks in a fee-for-service system be more connected with the providers. That provider may have more tools to connect with that patient if they're in that coordinated care ecosystem. And that's where something where OIG's coordinated care rule that came out a couple of years ago is an important sort of spot for folks to understand that if you're interested in value-based care, but you're worried about the regulatory and compliance risk, there are options now out there under the kickback statute and our safe harbors to move to those systems and do so in a purposeful way that both gets you off the sort of normal fee-for-service risks, overutilization, unnecessary care, and more to a accountability-based model that lets you really connect with patients in a different way and remove some of those regulatory barriers. And so I think for me, that's where the programmatic move in healthcare needs to go. If you're really serious about addressing health equity, I think getting off fee-for-service, which is demonstrated that hasn't served disadvantaged populations well based on the results we saw in the pandemic, that coordinated care is a great opportunity for folks to shift to address some of these long-term structural issues.
No, and I think that's a great point, because as you said, there have already been these changes that are coming into force. And I think that discussion around those opportunities and what is already starting to happen is a great place to unfortunately have to leave it off, because believe it or not, we're already out of time. I want to thank my guest, Andrew Van Landingham, for a great conversation today.
Well, thank you, Matt, and I appreciate your time today.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.